Does consciousness emerge from cosmos or vice versa? I'm going to give you three views, or my talk will be divided into three parts, namely, the first part of my talk, science, human consciousness emerged from the cosmos in these steps that I'll outline for you. The second part of my talk, I'll articulate the opposite point of view, that of religion, namely, the cosmos emerged from divine consciousness, namely, the Word of God, the Logos of God in the first chapter of John, and the Spirit of God in the first chapter of Genesis. And in the third part of my talk, I'll be reconciling these two points of view through biologos, the emergence of Homo sapiens, our kind of humans' sense of divine beauty, and the complementary beauty of science's how and spirit's why. Science takes things apart and puts them back together to understand how. Religion puts them back together to understand why. And emergence is a new move in science away from reductionism to putting things back together. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts, as you heard from our former speaker. More is different, according to physicist Philip Anderson's highly cited article on emergence. He emphasized the limitation of reductionism and the existence of hierarchical levels of science, each of which requires its own fundamental principles for advancement. Examples of emergence, the microscopic interaction of carbon atoms within their environmental constraints leads to different macroscopic properties. For example, when carbon atoms organize to form a face-centered cubic microscopic structure, and this is at very high temperatures and pressures, a macroscopic diamond emerges. When these same carbon atoms interact to form a microscopic hexagonal sheet, under different conditions of temperature and pressure, a soft graphite lubricant emerges, and we use that in pencil lead. Let's see how this plays out in the emergence of the present cool cosmos from the hot Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago. This temperature scale shows hot. At the beginning of the Big Bang, it was so hot, trillions of degrees, that none of the material universe could exist. It was all in a vapor, sort of vapor form. And as the universe cooled and expanded, we had the formation of protons and neutrons from quarks. And then and at 3 minutes, we had the synthesis of atomic nuclei. Now, what were the forces? Are people familiar with the forces, what that's called, the force that holds the nuclei together? Called the strong nuclear force. And then 300,000 years later, we had the first atoms. We had the positive nuclei and the negative electrons. The temperatures were low enough that atoms were no longer ionized. And what are the forces that hold the atom together? Positive nucleus, the negative electron. Electromagnetic, the electromagnetic force. And then as time progresses, we get the formation, and we get into the billion time frame, then we get the formation of stars, planets, and galaxies. And what is the force that brings them together? Do I hear gravitational? And the Earth was formed getting into the formation of the Earth and the emergence of life on Earth, but the Earth was formed out of the dust, the supernova of old stars. Those of you who remember last night, you saw the galactic dust. Remember we saw those pictures last night, the plenary of how gravity was pulling the dust of the cosmos, these cosmic explosions, to form new solar systems, new stars. And I'll be talking about that in a minute. And at the end of my talk, I'll actually show you photographs of what the cosmos looked like at 300,000 years and at 2 billion years. But the idea is that as the universe emerges, there are new laws that come into play. And Paul Davies says, I do not cling to the notion of God as a miracle-working cosmic magician who makes a big bang and intervenes as a cosmic repairman. A God who can create a self-creating universe with laws, namely the Logos, is much more majestic. As an emergentist, I believe in a hierarchy of principles with the laws of physics at the bottom level and emergent laws operating at higher levels. Thus, we have the laws of complexity, such as self-organizing chemical cycles. There are Mendel's laws of genetics when life appears. The higher level laws do not violate the lower level laws, nor are they reducible to them. They supervene on them. So let's see how these laws play out in the emergence of life on Earth. Earth is about 4.5 billion years old. It started as a very hot rock, which cooled, and it cooled the first life. The first cells appeared about 3.8 billion years ago. And we see a very long period of almost 3 billion years during which cells gradually emerged to become more complex. The more primitive prokaryote cells emerged into our present eukaryote cells with a nucleus, the genetic material confined to the nucleus. And at the same time, these cells emerged the ability to photosynthesis, in which they took the carbon dioxide, the carbon dioxide levels in the early universe were much higher than they are today, and they converted the carbon dioxide via the energy from the sun into oxygen. And so they built up the oxygen content, and it was this increasing oxygen content which enabled the Cambrian explosion of multicellular life that we know today. So we have two major transitions, the Cambrian explosion and then the transition from inanimate to the animate. And I'll go into those in more detail now. Here we have a plot of the oxygen level in the Earth starting about 1,000 million years ago, and then around 660 million years ago, it started building up due to the action of photosynthesis of our plant life. And then at 452 million years ago, according to this article, beginning of multicellular life, this is Keith Miller's article in the latest issue, the June issue of our Perspectives on Science and Christian Faith, we had the beginning of complex, the official beginning of the Cambrian explosion, and the oxygen levels still went up, and this is the sort of the levels we have today, sort of the mean levels that we have today. So, of course, this was very important because animals get their energy by oxidizing sugars, and bigger animals need more oxygen to maintain many more cells than a single cell has. Well, now let's talk about the three stages of life's emergence. I'm going to talk about how we went from the thermodynamic chaos, roughly 4.5 billion years ago. 4.5 billion years ago, we had atoms and molecules of water, methane, ammonia, carbon dioxide, moving randomly in the thermal fluctuations of a primordial soup. The second stage of emergence, according to anthropologist Terry Deacon, is the emergence of morphodynamics, or form, self-organizing order for free in the absence of dynamical variety. We started to get amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, stable autocatalytic chemical processes in which the output feeds back into the input. In other words, we have self-reducing or sustaining chemical processes. A major milestone scientifically was the Miller-Urey experiment, in which he subjected a mixture of water, hydrogen, methane, carbon dioxide, and ammonia that were present shortly after the beginning of the Earth to an electrical spark, which simulated lightning. They observed amino acids and the building blocks of life-forming proteins. I might also mention that there are amino acids in some of the meteorites that come to us from Mars and other heavenly bodies. And the third stage in emergence is that of life. And life is defined as having a purpose or a goal. And the simplest form of life is a self-replicating cell which emerged under ripe conditions from amino acids and proteins. Not highly probable, but remember, once you have something that replicates by factors of two each generation, for example, I think in 30 generations, you get like I think it's something like, I think a million descendants, and in 40 generations, you have a billion descendants, and in 40 generations, which is not, you get a trillion. So you get this exponential growth of life. Even though it may not be probable, once you have it, it just takes off. And the vital purpose of a cell is to eat and avoid its absence or being eaten, of being eaten. So a cell has to eat and not be eaten. That's a basic purpose, or a minimal vital purpose of each cell. Going into more details of Terry Deacon's stage 3 emergence, and also getting into his chapter on consciousness, he says that cells and brainless plants have sentience, namely they respond to their environment, but they're not conscious. He says consciousness is the final quasi-regular network-like, dynamic-like melody played by a million instrument orchestra. This is the medium of mental information. In my view, he should have said trillions of instruments. Those would be the number of cells that we, neurons we have in our brain. They're more like trillions than millions. Thereby, a Deacon thereby formulates a naturalistic scientific worldview. Consciousness and psyche emerge from the firing of our neurons, but he says they can't be reduced to them. Now he notes that cells have sentience, but we, like we humans, have consciousness. So I think he's starting to define different levels of consciousness. And here's some of the thoughts of the philosopher David Chalmers, who advocates panpsychism. He says that our macro consciousness emerges from the micro consciousness or sentience of our neurons. And expressing this as a Hegelian dialectic, he said that panpsychism emerges from the thesis that everything is material. The ultimate reality is material and equivalently energy. The antithesis that matter and mind are separate, and panpsychism means that everything has a degree of mind or consciousness. Now this would apply to atoms and dirt, and it has a lower degree of consciousness, but at least it avoids a discontinuity and makes this a very logical statement, that macro consciousness emerging from the micro consciousness of neurons in the case of our brain. Well, let's talk about consciousness beyond life. This is a book, a title of a book by the cardiologist Pim Van Lommel, The Science of Near-Death Experience. And he has studied for decades the near-death experience of hundreds of patients, which he published in the refereed and renowned medical journal Lancet, well known in the UK. He concludes that the current views on the relationship between the brain and consciousness held by most physicians, philosophers, and psychologists are too narrow for a proper understanding of the phenomenon. He shows that our consciousness does not always coincide with brain functions, and that consciousness can be experienced separate from the body. Now, that's quite a claim. This reminded me, by the way, of when computer scientists talk about extended memory, for example. And I don't have time to go into that today, but let me sort of summarize where we're at here. I'm about halfway through. We've talked about science in which human consciousness emerged from the cosmic Big Bang, how the mind emerged from matter. And I must say that research on this naturalist worldview on human consciousness and psyche is very much continuing. There are international conferences on the subject of consciousness, for example. So let's now morph into, particularly since I've talked about the concept that there's the possibility of consciousness existing apart from the brain. That's a nice segue into the religious worldview, namely that the cosmos emerged from divine consciousness. As we read in John, in the beginning was the Word, or the Logos, and the Logos was God, and the Logos was with God. We read in Isaiah, how beautiful on the mountains are the feet of them that bringeth good tidings. Jesus brought us this good news. The world was made by him because he was with the creating Spirit of God in the beginning. Now this idea is somewhat similar to the Hinduism. Consciousness has an independent existence in the divine Brahman. Human consciousness is a small fragment of this divine consciousness. And this is somewhat idea similar to our Trinitarian idea of the Spirit of God within us, that God's transcendent spirit a small part of it is within us. This book, Consciousness Explained Better, Towards an Integral Understanding of the Multifaceted Nature of Consciousness by psychologist Alan Coombs, says consciousness is not relativistic and culturally defined. There are universal states and streams of evolutions of consciousness. This is consonant with the Jung's idea of the collective unconscious, and in which dream symbols seem to be universal and cross-cultural. He also makes the very important and almost religious statement, consciousness is not merely viewed as an epiphenomena emerging from the material stuff of our brains. Rather, it is an integral part of the cosmos itself. And by the way, he's a close friend of Wilbur. So now I want to move on to the final part of my talk, the reconciliation of science and religion. Biologos, or I call it theistic evolution, and I was speaking to Dr. Hertzimer this morning, and she said they maybe call it, this is sort of the way, this is the way God created, in other words. And then the emergence of Homo sapiens with a sense of beauty which points toward the divine. And thirdly, the complementary beauty of science and spirit. Science is how beautifully complements religion's why. Francis Collins, the founder of Biologos, said, "I find those rare moments of scientific discovery in my own experience to be moments of worship also, where a revelation of some intricacy of God's creation is appreciated for the first time." And I think we all know that he headed the team that sequenced the human genome. And I'm sure after 10 years of research, which some people said wasn't possible when they started, I think it took 10 years, that this was indeed a moment of worship for him, and I would think all other, particularly theistic members of his team. Biologos, the organization that was founded as a result of the strong response that he got to his book. It was on the bestseller New York Times bestseller list. It was called "The Language of God," what is biologos? Well, bios is the Greek word for life. And logos is the Greek word with a broader meaning in philosophy and Stoicism, namely the rational principle ordering the universe. In Christian theology, the word includes the Hebrew idea of a creative agent for all that exists, namely God, in addition to being an ordering principle. Biologos expresses that God is the source of all life, and life expresses the will of God. Biologos represents the view that evolutionary science and religious faith coexist in harmony. In my book, Beauty and Science of Spirit, some of the points that I made, the emergent evolutionary process produced our kind of human who sees beauty in the natural world. Even atheists, I think, would see beauty in the natural world. The mathematician and physicist Henri Poincaré said, "If nature weren't beautiful, it would not be worth knowing." And this was his in the context of why do scientists study nature? It's because they find it beautiful. Historically, I think the reason why astronomy is the oldest science is that our ancient people were awed by the beauty of the heavens, and they wanted to understand the mathematics and make predictions and know why the moon, for example, has phases and so forth. I personally experienced beauty in both science and religion. In scientific theory, the comprehensiveness and predictability of scientific theories and understanding, and I find beauty in religious music, art, liturgy. This is salvation, when we marvel at the beauty of created things and praise the beautiful providence of the Creator. That's Meister Eckhart, the German mystic theologian. The thirst for beauty that permeates our lives is an opening for transcendence, according to Lutheran theologian Philip Hefner. Beauty's self and beauty's giver. That's a quote from the Jesuit poet Gerald Manley Hopkins. Here is beauty, whatever those who have never looked at a butterfly may say. And this is a photograph of my niece's little son observing this butterfly up here. Beauty that rejoices and humbles. Beauty remote from all that is meant by words like random or purposeless, utilitarian or materialistic. Beauty and its impact is akin to an authentic encounter with God. Here's the beauty of the universe. From cooler, I showed you the time scale, from cooler temperatures. This is a plot of the temperature, an angular report of the radiation of the universe. This is before there was any material use. This is the radiative, the temperature of the cosmic radiation 3/10 million years after the beginning. And then 2 billion years after the beginning, we have this amazing, which you saw last night at the plenary, the Hubble Deep Field image of the galaxies 12 billion light years away. This reminds me of a quote. The exquisite beauty and elegance of the portion of the universe that we can explain overwhelmingly display the glory of God. That's a quote from Randy Isaac in one of his articles written in 05. From cosmos to psyche, that's the theme of our conference. John Wheeler's Participatory Universe. Human consciousness and our eyes have emerged from the beginning of the universe here to look back 3.8 billion years and ask, how did we get here and why? So we are made of stardust. Our atoms were created in the supernova and forged in the stars and created. And the universe, we are, in a sense, we humans are the universe conscious of itself and looking back in time and saying, how did we get here and why? So in summary, science says that our human consciousness emerged from the cosmos. It tells us how mind emerged from the matter of the Big Bang. The cosmos and humans are continuing to emerge and evolve. I might mention that in our Origin of Life workshop, we made the point was made that many atheist scientists like Dawkins make the point that this Darwinian evolution is purposeless, and it's actually it's agnostic. And Darwin, at the conclusion of his Origin of the Species, did not say that. He said, there is grandeur in this view of life with its several powers, having originally been breathed by the Creator, not into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone on cycling according to a fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and wonderful, have been and are being evolved. But science in and of itself is complete. It doesn't answer why there is a cosmos, and what's the purpose of it. Religion complements science. It says that the cosmos emerged from divine consciousness, and that answers the question of how the Big Bang got there, for those who are theistic. As we read before, Jesus brought us the good news. The world was made by him because he was with the creating spirit of God in the beginning. All things hold together in him. But religion is incomplete in the sense it doesn't show how the cosmos emerged. It doesn't really give us any predictions either. So we need the reconciliation of science and religion. Biologos telling us that God and Christ create via evolution and emergence, and emergence and our sense of beauty as an encounter of the divine. So we have completeness in the complementary beauty of science's how and religion's why. So thank you.
So we certainly have some time for questions. So go ahead.
Thank you very much. That's fascinating. In your second point, it seems to me you are affirming the distinction of divine consciousness from the cosmos. In your first point, you're denying the distinction of human consciousness from the cosmos.
From a strictly secular scientific point of view.
I just don't see how you can have it both ways in terms of human consciousness being something which is directly in the image of logos and the divine and appreciates beauty and is intimate to every moment of our consciousness.
Well, I personally...
I don't see how you can have human consciousness, both non-distinct from the cosmos, and yet totally and utterly in the image and flowing from the divine consciousness, which is totally distinct.
I think most of us at this conference who are believing Christians would agree with you. However, I've also lived as a secular science in the laboratory, and when you go to a scientific meeting, you don't talk about. Our workshop on the origin of human organs, he says, I'm presenting a secular scientific worldview, and this is a secular scientific worldview.
They should take account of that at that moment. If they're beginning to discuss reality, they're using their consciousness to understand the beauty and stunningness of the world. And there is, David Chalmers, I think, is a very prominent philosopher of mind, but there are people, and I don't think he's totally uninterested in a smaller school that is saying human intentionality, human ability to know, is a fundamental datum of all experience in its distinctness from the objects of sensation.
Well, I think you make a very good point. I basically agree with you, but I'm just saying that the secular scientific community, believes this. I mean, if you go to a scientific meeting, that is a problem, but I'm just saying, if you go to an astronomy conference, The idea that human consciousness is divine, that issue never comes up. If you talk to professional astronomers, there are Christian, yes.
So a question from the back, from Bob. You had a question?
I have two quick questions. I'm not sure I'm conscious half the time. How would you define consciousness?
Pardon?
Could you define consciousness?
Well, I think it's basically awareness. For humans, it's perception and awareness. Not in the human sense, no, because they don't, they have a different, they're basically they're designed by us. If maybe someday we can program a computer to be conscious and
by your definition, I think computers could be conscious. The other question I have is that emergent. By the way, thank you for a fascinating talk. It's very fun. Emergence could be indeed the driving force allowing us to be here, but in order for that to be true, there would have to be a lot of dominoes set up to knock down in order to distinguish this emergence. In my experience, any simulation of emergence has only shown minor sort of things, minor sort of developments, minor sort of outcomes. In order for this to happen, you have to have a whole chain of them.
Well, speaking of computer simulations, everybody who does computer simulations, and I'm very familiar with computer simulations of our climate, and the general consensus of people who do it, it says, don't trust computer simulations because they're basically designed by us. So that they're subject. I mean, they're not original, and the algorithms came from us. And so I don't look at computers as being autonomous yet.
Well, wouldn't it be the case if you're going to come up with a theory of emergence, you should be able to develop the math behind it, if indeed it's algorithmic? Possibly it's not algorithmic.
Yeah, well, that's an open question as to whether you can. I say scientists are working toward that, but I think it's going to be a long way. Yeah, we got another?
Last question from Ike, who was asking earlier, and then that'll be the last question for this particular talk.
As somebody who's really new to this, and you've talked a lot about computer simulations, the cosmologists think they do a pretty good job using the tools of science to simulate how the universe got the shape that it has today. Is there a point at which what we can do with our scientific information has got to be set aside and we look for something we call emergence to explain things we haven't explained yet? Is there a boundary there?
I think you mean the emergence of new properties. You mean, yeah, that's right. I mean, we start.
They think they were working just fine just with general relativity and quantum mechanics. So when does that run out of gas and we have to invoke emergence?
Oh, I don't really know. And can anyone help me? Does anyone else have any ideas?
Some of these ideas will come up in our panelists. Thank you very much once again, Paul.
Okay.